April is National Bilingual and Multilingual Learner Advocacy Month. That's why we're so excited to tell you about a new special series from Science of Reading, the podcast, that will launch later this month. Over several episodes, we'll talk to leading researchers and practitioners about how the science of reading serves multilingual and English learners, and how to best use the science of reading to support those students in the classroom. That's all starting at the end of this month. Stay tuned to this feed for more.
These are challenging times, and we respect your unwavering commitment to your students. At Amplify, we are working especially hard to support you. And as we all grapple with what it means to focus on the science of reading in a new world of remote learning, we're committed to walking with you through the unknown. Welcome to Science of Reading, the podcast. I'm your host, Susan Lambert. Join us as we talk with experts to explore what it takes to develop joyful, confident, and capable readers. Our guest today, Dr. Sean Joseph, is passionate about shedding light on what he calls the silent crisis in literacy. With over 20 years of experience as a classroom teacher, literacy coach, and district administrator, Sean knows firsthand how low literacy rates often go unnoticed and are part of a culture of low expectations. We talk about the importance of all students reading at grade level and what it takes to accomplish that. He believes this issue is one of the most important civil rights issues of our day. Well, hi, Sean. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So as you know, I always like to start by asking our guests to tell the listeners a little bit about themselves and how you ended up both in education and also interested in literacy.
Oh, wow. So, gosh, I've been in education now for 24 years.
Wow.
No, time flies when you're having fun. And, I got into education because I attended Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, America's oldest historically black college. And while I was there, I met a young man who couldn't read. I participated in an upward bound program. I felt like that was the first time God had ever talk to me, because I just couldn't understand how does America allow somebody to get to 11th grade and not be able, to read. So, originally I was a biology major, and I switched my major from biology to English education back in 1994. And I've spent, these past 24 years really trying to get it right for kids, and that journey has taken me to being an English teacher, reading specialist, principal, supervising principals in a large district in the Mid-Atlantic region of the country, being a superintendent in a small rural district, to being a chief academic officer in a large diverse district in the Mid-Atlantic region, to ultimately becoming a superintendent of schools in the South. And now I'm working as a professor of educational administration. So it's been a journey, but those years we've always kept equity in mind and trying to get things right for kids.
Mm. And did you make that shift because of that interaction with that young man?
Absolutely. It just angered me. Until this day, we still see across this country a silent crisis with kids not being able to read on grade level, particularly, in that focus in the early years, because what we see is those cumulative deficits build over time. So if we don't catch it early, it's almost never caught. And you have millions of children, in this country that have not been given a basic civil right, which is the right to read. So.
And you called it silent. Can you explain a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Yeah, so when I was superintendent, for example, in the large urban district in the South, 3 out of 4 children in that district did not read on grade level by third grade. Hmm. Think about that. 3 out of 4 kids are not reading on grade level, and nobody was talking about it. It hadn't been a situation where there were, years of people fighting and trying to figure out what they can do and prioritizing resources and rallying the community, informing parents, asking, you know, what are the best practices to, you know, eradicate this unfortunate situation in our community. It just went unnoticed, or it was just accepted that, you know, some kids will get it, most kids won't. And, you know, that's just the way it is. And it baffles me. And this, you know, like I said, this is my 24th year in education. And that is not uncharacteristic. You know, you see study after study, report after report, indicating that literacy in America is a problem. But, you know, there's been no national convening to say we're going to treat this as a, you know, a serious national problem. And let's find the resources that are needed to make sure we can solve the problem, because it is a problem that can be solved. You know, it just will take resources and support to build the capacity of teachers and making sure that they have the right materials and the right approaches to address the issues.
Why do you think it is that people haven't been talking about it, that it ends up being just this thing that folks accept is just going to happen?
You know, honestly, I believe our economy, I mean, our economy is, you know, driven by, you know, right, economics and capitalism. And in a capitalistic society, you know, you must have people who are at the top of the food chain and people at the bottom. And I think limiting reading opportunities for children destines them to those jobs that don't pay much. You know, I mean, I think it's a, I mean, I do think it's a very much an issue of oppression, you know, racial oppression. I think it's classist. You know, we expect some communities that are particularly communities across this country that are poor. We just don't expect enough from our children, and we don't expect them to be able to graduate college and career ready and go off and, you know, create jobs and own jobs. We are a nation that benefits off of, you know, cheap labor. I mean, that's my conspiracy theory anyway. Because I think if it was that important, it would be addressed.
Right. And you have credibility or experience to speak to that, given all the different situations that you've been in across the country in different kinds of roles as it relates to literacy.
Absolutely.
You seen that? Have you seen that as a, you know, common thread then of your work?
Yeah, I mean, I know every place I've been, I have prioritized reading and reading achievement, and I've brought to bear, you know, the fact that, one, we got to know where our children are in terms of, do we have the right assessments to even be able to communicate to parents and for our teachers to know where children are starting. And it's, again, in many places that I've been, we didn't even know how well the kids were reading. Right. So problem number one, and that's one of the reasons it might go silent, because if you're not measuring accurately, then
right,
there's no way to communicate. Two, you know, I've always focused on making sure teachers had the materials that they needed, and we were clear that, you know, it takes a balanced approach. I mean, phonics are important, but they're not the only answer.
Right.
You know, students have to be engaged with rich literature, and they, you know, must know how to think deeply about that literature and engage to make meaning, you know, and make sense and make meaning and to comprehend. And we've just not, you know, I mean, I don't accept when a district says, you know, we don't have, you know, the resources or funds to you know, address the literacy crisis, because we prioritize what we think is important. And I don't think there's anything more important than prioritizing the literacy efforts within a district. Like if you've got to make tough decisions, literacy shouldn't be one of those decisions that gets cut.
Yeah. I know one of the conversations that's happening right now as it relates to the science of reading or, what kids need to have to become proficient readers is that this is a real issue of equity. How do you respond to that?
Oh yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, like I said, this is the civil rights issue of our day. Kids not having access and the opportunity to read on grade level. And I think school leaders across the country have to look at it that way. And they must, engage with their school boards. They must engage with their local politicians. They have to engage at the state. And start speaking much more clearly and with much more urgency about this is the equity issue. We are going through this pandemic at the moment, and people are talking about the equity issues that we see with technology. Well, long before there were technology issues, there were literacy issues, and I don't think we should lose sight on that. And I do think that there are ways that you can actually utilize technology to help with the literacy efforts, but that's another discussion.
For sure.
But we must put first things first. And in my book, making sure kids can read and making sure literacy is a priority, is the first thing we must do.
Now, I know that I'd like to do a little segue because I know that you went beyond sort of lip service to this idea that literacy is an equity issue, and in many of your different roles, you've sort of doubled down on saying, no, we're going to make this a real commitment. So let's talk a little bit about being in a very large urban district, and maybe what was the state of literacy when you first started in that district, and what did you go in really wanting for those students?
Yeah, so when I'd say the first real exposure I had to the work at the district level was when I was the deputy superintendent for teaching and learning in a district with about 135,000 students and 204 schools
Wow.
in the Mid-Atlantic region of the country. And there, I mean, what I immediately saw was that we had lots of different approaches to literacy instruction within the district. That from school to school, things varied. Some people had a large emphasis on phonics, other people were totally, whole language. Some people were focused on balanced literacy, but it wasn't clear about our approach to literacy. And we saw, just huge variances in performance from school to school. And we also saw huge variances with the materials that were available for students and for teachers from school to school. And another thing that we saw there was that we did not have assessments that measured, that were aligned to what the standards were for literacy. So, we were giving assessments, and those assessments were saying the kids were, reading great, but the standards were dramatically higher than what the assessments were saying. So it was a false positive, if you will. So we had to go in and make sure we had high quality assessment, as I shared. We had to make sure we had a clear approach to literacy that we would focus on as an entire district. Then we had to make sure we put literacy experts in, all of our buildings, and people who really understood the science of literacy, who could be a key advisor to the principal and to the staffs in those buildings. To make sure that they had assessments and they had assessment literacy to be able to communicate what the assessments were saying, that they had appropriate literacy materials within the buildings, that they had a consistent, clear method of instruction within buildings, and those individuals could communicate back to the central office what was working, what were the challenges, and, you know, we could create a professional learning community to really get at where we were, why we were there, and what supports were needed to help improve. And in that district, we developed a literacy plan for the first time in the district to communicate to parents and to principals and to teachers. This is what we mean by literacy. This is our approach, and these are the best practices that we can employ. You know, so when I became a superintendent in a large district in the South, amazingly, the same process had to start over because they were in the same place with the same issues.
Wow.
Where I had left.
Hmm. Yeah. What was the response when you put literacy plans in front of large districts like that? What kind of response did you get?
You know, I think, well, from the teachers, they were extremely appreciative because, you know, they knew they had been, you know, struggling with getting it right for kids. Hmm. You know, I think I don't think any teacher wants the children in front of them not to succeed. You know, I just think, you know, most teachers want to see their children, you know, dramatically grow over the course of their time together. And I think in both districts, teachers were frustrated because they were given this large task. I mean, with lots of students who did not speak English as a first language, children who did not grow up in, you know, literacy-rich backgrounds, and therefore many of the kindergarten teachers would share, you know, kids came to school and this was the first time they were exposed to actually having a book in their hands or, you know, being in a literacy environment. And, you know, many of them were frustrated with the fact that they didn't even have appropriate materials to teach. And, you know, they went through a university program, but they really didn't consider themselves experts in the teaching of reading. And for me, I think it's important that a school district take the time to expect all teachers to be experts in the teaching of reading, but to do that, you have to provide them with training and support and materials to allow them to get that work done. So the teachers were appreciative. I think it made sense to parents. It made sense to politicians. Many of the politicians that I spoke with were in disbelief that we were in this state because nobody had ever put the data and the facts in front of them to say this is something we must do. So, you know, the lesson is leaders in our school districts need to make it an issue because if they don't, it will not be one. And again, it'll be that silent assassin in the community that nobody talks about, but everybody knows, you know, these kids are not prepared.
It seems, I'm just sitting here listening to you talk, and it feels like it must have been quite overwhelming for you, because I know you told me previously that when you first went to this district, probably every district you've been in, you made it a point to visit classrooms.
Yes.
But it must have felt extremely overwhelming to go from classroom to classroom to classroom and school to school to school and see the discrepancies within one district. And how did you know where to start?
Yeah, it's heartbreaking, actually. I was fortunate. So part of my journey was I attended Johns Hopkins University and I got a master's in the teaching of reading after I got my undergraduate degree. So, For me, I had a deep understanding as a leader of the science of reading. So walking into buildings and observing and talking to teachers and looking at materials and asking questions, I could get a sense of what was missing and what was needed. And the enemy that we were fighting was variance. I mean, the variance from classroom to classroom and the variance from school to school in terms of understanding the science of reading. So I've always looked at this as a war against variance. And how do we minimize the variance to get this right and empower people with the tools and resources that they need so we can have some consistency? Because one of the challenges that large urban districts face is there tends to be high mobility, students leaving one school, going to another school. And if you don't have a consistent program, that mobility becomes an additional challenge for you to overcome. And so it's a huge investment when if you're starting from ground zero. I mean, you have to find a way to really look within your budgets and work with your school board and your local funders and your state funders to get the resources that are needed to just create this transformation. And when you're talking about a large urban district, like I said, the district I was superintendent in, I mean, we're talking about 6,000 teachers. It's more than an ocean to turn that ship in a different direction. But that's why it takes clarity and it takes clear communication about the urgency of the times and the moment. It's sort of like another type of pandemic moment where you just have to say, all of a sudden the world just changes and we're going to go down this new path because we must. On behalf of these kids.
It's amazing to me, and when I talk to people outside the education world, and I think many parents have this assumption that if I'm in a district, no matter if it's small or if it's large, I would assume that if I went to one school, the kind of resources they have access to that are in their classrooms, that are closest to the kids, would be the same as another school within the same district. But that's not true, is it?
That's not true at all. No.
And why
I
is
mean,
that?
lots of reasons. A basic reason could just be your local politics. You find in districts across the country, there tend to be pockets of affluence and there tends to be, more challenged communities. And sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes, in those communities that are more affluent, there's this mindset that, we pay more taxes, therefore we should have more resources from the budget. And they can tend to have, more political savvy because those are the parents that, come and scream and demand for resources and, the squeaky, wheel gets the oil. So that happens a lot, and I've seen that happen in many districts, including the last district I was in as superintendent. That in the more affluent schools, you see lots of technology, lots of resources. There are parents in those communities that are able to donate dollars to have classroom libraries and other items. But in your poorest, neediest schools, there's nothing, and there's no one advocating for them, advocating for their needs, or bringing in those extra resources. And that's where leaders must have, the courage to say, if no one is, if we don't have parents demanding and advocating in those schools and parts of the community, I as the leader must advocate and speak on their behalf. I mean, children need powerful, strong adults fighting for them because they can't do it by themselves.
And in your own work, how have you found that to be? Has it been, have you been successfully able to advocate? Has it been a little more frustrating?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely frustrating, I think, because what happened, the powers that be, the political powers definitely can push back on you. I mean, I think, leading for equity is dangerous work. It shouldn't be.
Why do you say that?
Well, because, again, within a community, when you have limited resources and you have competing interest, for you as a leader to talk about equity and, talk about giving people what they need to achieve the standards, those in power might feel that there's a potential sense of a potential loss coming. And they'll fight against that loss, that perception of loss, or sometimes it is a reality of reducing the amount of resource that goes to the north to provide more resource in the south. But monitoring, but the key about equity and the good thing about equity is, you're monitoring what does it take for students to reach a standard, and if you can reprioritize some resource from the north to better support greater need in the south, but simultaneously nobody falls short of achieving the standard, then that's a good thing. But we get into this, just this selfish mindset, I think, across the country that is debilitating. I mean, just think about it again, going back to the pandemic came and there was a mad dash for, toilet tissue, right? And everywhere you went, you'd see people, with 10 reams of toilet tissue in their, their shopping cart. And you'll see the person next to you has none, you have 10, and you just look at them and continue walking. it's that bad part of human nature that we just need to be better about.
Yeah. So, yeah, that hurts my heart. when you think about in comparison, you were also in a much smaller district and more rural, we'll say.
Yes.
Like, what is the similarities or differences in terms of literacy and approach?
Yeah, the similarities were that whether it was a small rural district or a large urban district, there was limited resources, and you, as the leader, had to figure out how to prioritize limited resources to move things forward. I think in a small rural district, you don't have the same political climate that you do in a large urban district. There are no newspapers and news crews constantly, kind of lurking around, looking to try to expose something. You don't have that scenario, and because you don't have $1 billion budget like you might have in a large urban district, you don't have as many vultures kind of flying around demanding a piece of the pie. So the politics are different dramatically, but what is similar is the lack of resource and sometimes the lack of focus towards literacy efforts. But that takes the vision of a board, and the vision of a superintendent to help the district prioritize the resources they have to get better outcomes for kids.
So a common theme there of highlighting and uncovering sort of this literacy issue.
Yes.
So it sounds to me like this has been something that you've been focused on in every sort of place that you've been in, is that you really felt a responsibility to highlight the issue.
Absolutely. 24 years. And I mean, the good news is, I think my, you know, in every district that I've been in, every district that is focused on literacy and has really understood, you know, what the science of reading is about and has resourced and prioritized and pushed and reflected and assessed has gotten better. You know, when I left my last district, and again, it was the 43rd largest district in America, you know, located in the South. You know, when I got there, we were growing slower than the nation in reading for every student group, and growing slower than, you know, in every student group in the state. And when I left, we were growing faster than the nation as measured by, you know, a national formative assessment that we used to monitor how students were going along the way. And we started growing faster than the state of Tennessee on Tennessee's rigorous state assessments. And our ACT scores started growing faster than the state for the first time, you know, on assessments. And it's not rocket science why we focused, you know. You know, and we saw on the state assessments that our growth was a level 5, which meant that we were growing dramatically faster than the state in grades 3 through 8 in literacy.
That's
so it
amazing.
Can, yeah. So the good news is it can be done.
Right.
The bad news is, I mean, we still, even though we were growing faster than the state, we still had, you know, 3 out of 4 kids not reading on grade level. I mean, it's a long-term journey. Like,
right.
You know, that problem doesn't quickly solve because unfortunately you have, you know, thousands of kids in the pipeline. I mean, in that district, we had 86,000 children. So, you know, while you're reorganizing, realigning, and refocusing efforts at the, you know, pre-K through third grade level, you still have kids grades 4 through 12 that have been in the pipeline that
right.
you missed, and you have to figure out, you know, how to address that. But because those, like I said earlier, those cumulative deficits do build over time.
Right.
But, you know, one thing districts must understand is that, you know, no district ever remediates itself into excellence.
Yeah, I heard you say that before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There must be a focus on first instruction and in getting it right the first time and getting it right with high quality materials, getting it right with high quality training. You know, getting it right with high quality assessments to measure how kids are moving along the way. I mean, all of that has to be there the first time. And you can't put more dollars in remediation programs than you do in your first instruction program. That will destine you to always be behind.
That's really powerful. And you know, I'm going to ask you this question, and I'm just wondering if you've already answered it, but when you think about the work that you did there, what are you, like, most proud of?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm proud of the fact that I wasn't afraid to, you know, I think do what was right, you know, and again, against, sometimes, you know, against, the wishes of powers that existed, you know, in terms of my bosses and so forth. You know, I'm proud of the fact that I didn't play politics. I was clear about what my mission was. And I think I was clear about what it took to really have a positive impact on children's outcomes. You know, you know, you fight your battles, and you know, I gave it a good fight until I just felt it was time to move on. But I didn't. I'm you know, so, lots of leaders bow down and buckle to the political pressures that they may get from, you know, board members or from community members who I think maybe sometimes have, you know, they have good intentions. I think they might want to get things right, but they're just not accurate in their approach. And so, you know, they may be trying to convince you to use a particular program or particular process and invest in that and you know that that's not the best thing to do, and having the courage to say, you know, I just can't do that because I know it's gonna have us where we've been. You know, there's a reason we're here. And if we keep doing the same thing, we're going to continue to be in the same place.
So really, I'm going to maybe say it in a different way, that it seems to me that you have always put what's best for the students and what is good for the kids ahead of what's good for the adults.
I think that's the mark of an excellent urban leader, because, you know, urban districts are filled with politics, and at the end of the day, you must keep kids first at all cost, and sometimes it will cost you your job. You know, make no mistake about it. You know, but that's okay. I think if you focus on your mission, you know, you'll always have a job. If you focus on your job, you might miss your mission.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Well, given our current environment that's really re-highlighting this, you know, institutional racism, from your experience, I'd love to hear, like, how have you seen this manifest itself in schools and districts? I mean, you talked a little bit about at the beginning of this silent crisis of not knowing. You didn't even know the kids that were failing because there was no assessment in place to really understand how they were doing. But broadening that out a little bit, how have you seen this in schools and districts?
Yeah, I think public school districts perpetuate institutional racism more so than any other public body, in my opinion. And I think that happens through the policies that are in place within districts. You know, in my last school district, for example, you know, they had a policy where they would allow elementary students, you know, a kindergartner, to be arrested. You know, police could be called, come into the building, arrest a kindergartner because they were, you know, unruly or had some emotional need that was unmet that manifested itself in some type of behavior. You know, I mean, that's a policy. I mean, and you know, I fought and ultimately worked with the board to change, you know, those types of policies. It's never acceptable for, you know, a kindergartner to be put in the police car and, you know, zip cuffs because they're, you know, they're too small to have handcuffs, so they got the little zip cuffs on them. That is a racist, in my opinion, policy, because more often than not, there are, you know, little black and brown children that are getting hauled away because some adult doesn't want to deal with helping them deal with whatever the social emotional issue is that needs to be at the root cause of the issue. You know, I think when you look in many school districts, gifted and talented classes, and, you know, you can identify a gifted and talented class in a diverse school just by the racial makeup of the classroom. That is a policy that school leaders have put in place to accept that in this district, you know, even though, you know, you might be 80% minority, 80% of black and brown children are not in gifted and talented programs, mm-hmm. you know, or nowhere close. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just basic common sense says, I mean, unless giftedness has something to do with race, something just doesn't seem right here when we look at how our classes are made up. Again, that's a policy issue that has to be looked at. When you look at who's getting suspended and what they're getting suspended for, you know, that's a policy issue that you're dealing with. You know, one of the things that you know, I noted in my last district was, you know, we didn't have many kids at the time of my arrival in 2016 taking lots of advanced placement courses, or, you know, they were going through these sequences, CTE course sequences, to get career technology education certifications. But many kids weren't getting the certifications. Well, why? Well, the answer was because, you know, you're in a district that was, you know, 80% of the students, you know, weren't wealthy. You know, they, you know, received free and reduced meals, which is an indication of poverty. Mm-hmm. And those tests were pretty expensive,
right?
To take. Mm-hmm. So those children just couldn't afford to take the test. You know, that's something I went to the board and said, if it's important enough for us to offer AP classes, you know, advanced placement classes, or have these industry certification pathways, it should be important enough for us to pay for the test and expect students to take the test. And again, that's a decision point and a value system point, you know, and I didn't want to hear, well, you know, most of the kids are poor, most of the kids won't do well on the test, you know, because that is you, you know, casting your low expectations on what the kids can or can do. I mean, children will rise to the level of expectations that are set for them.
Right. Yeah.
So the question becomes, what are the expectations that we're setting? So, you know, so those are some of the things. So we changed that, and then we started offering, we started paying for all kids to take advanced placement courses and all industry certifications. And miraculously, you know, we doubled the amount of kids taking the test and doubled the amount of kids passing the exams.
Wow. That's amazing.
You know, so those are the things that, you know, I was proud of there. So I, you know, in the midst of the fights, you know, we stayed true to doing what's right. And, you know, and when I left the district, I felt very good. And in the time that I was there, I did what I thought was right for kids. And I know more kids had more opportunities. And I mean, that's what public education should be about. I mean, a child shouldn't come to a public school system disadvantaged and leave disadvantaged. I mean, then you've failed at your job. I mean, I believe a child should go to a public institution and leave that public institution with advantages, because in that environment, that anti-racist environment, there were people who created opportunities, access, and expected. And as a result, you got better outcomes and put kids in a much different place to be able to go out and deal with, you know, the challenges that would lie outside of the building and outside of the schools.
Yeah.
Because they do exist, as we've seen.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier something about education being the civil rights issue of today. What kind
Absolutely.
Of hope, what kind of hope do you have that that's possible in maybe even both the short term and the long term?
Yeah. You know, it's going to take a collected community effort. You know, the same energy that we see now with the protesters out there fighting and demanding social justice and the end of racism, that same energy has to be seen in local school board meetings across this country. And, you know, at local council meetings across this country, and at state board of education meetings across this country, for things to change. You know, I just think we're such a classist country now, those with means choose to be around others with means. And, if we can afford to opt out and accept a privilege, we do. If we don't speak up and speak out, the inequities will continue because, we're a country that's built upon inequity. Once again, I mean, this nation was built upon inequity. I mean, it was built upon slave labor, right? Mm-hmm. And haves and have-nots, and privileged and underclassed, and to dismantle that, and noticing, and I must say, when you work to dismantle those, that scenario, there are people of privilege that potentially can lose something, and people of privilege don't lose something without a fight. Therein lies the challenge that we have with some of the isms that we must battle. But those of us that know must speak out and must fight, just because it's the right thing to do. And it shouldn't take, a video of us seeing an atrocity to mobilize us.
Well, we are definitely thankful to you, and I know I am, for the work that you have done in the past, and I know that you're going to continue to do. Fighting for things that are right takes energy and persistence and time. And I'm wondering, as we wrap up, what would you like to give our listeners ideas or thoughts or concepts for them to take away from today's episode to really help sustain that momentum?
Yeah, no, so I would say all across the country, and if anyone that's listening to this particular podcast, I hope you take away the notion that, one, we have to fight for our children in for public education, and we have to make sure that our voices are heard at our local board meetings. They have to be heard in our city council meetings, and they have to be heard in our at the state house. That your political activity is essential, and your ability to mobilize is essential. And I also think for so many people, politics is a bad word. But change only happens when people enter the political process and advocate for what's right. Mm-hmm. And now is the time for people to reclaim their voices and use its power to speak on those things that we see are wrong, that can be corrected if we just hold those in power accountable for doing what's morally right for everybody.
Well, thank you so much for those wise words. And again, thank you for joining us today.
This was awesome. Thank you.
We're so grateful to our amazing guest today and to all of you making a difference in the lives of students every single day. Be sure to check the show notes for resource links from today's podcast, and we want to hear your stories and successes. Follow us on Facebook at Science of Reading the Community, or if you're looking to help implement the science of reading, send an email to sormatters@amplify.com. Tell us what guests you think we should book, or tell us about the research that really excites you. And be sure to hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. Until next time, I'm Susan Lambert.